angels you're looking at, and they know that this recurring, what they call it, the recurring slope linear, RSLs, they're maybe 300 feet long, and maybe, you know, 30 feet wide or something, and there's hundreds of them coming down these mountains, and all over different locations around Mars. And over the years, you can tell from Mars Spring to a Mars Fall, you know, which is roughly two, you know, it's a 2-to-1 ratio, you know, it's not every year, so it's every 2 years they can tell the difference in these recurring slope linears. And then, you know, sometimes they're there, and then in the summertime they go away. And they know that with enough, you know, they can extrapolate how much water is behind these things. And they could, I forget, you know, you could fill up Lake Superior or something with all, you know, the total amount of water that they could find just from these things. That's without digging out the ice. But they know that they have a good chance of getting a lot of water once they land on Mars. Getting it out of the ground might be something else. It's not like it's flowing where you can pick it up with a bucket. You know, you're going to have to, you know, probably mine or, you know, so get some kind of equipment to take this stuff and try to put it into a tank. That's not going to be easy. They'd rather find it. Where is it coming from? Is it on the ground, further, you know, dug into the mountain somewhere where they can dig it out easier? It's going to be a problem getting the water. You can dig out the ice, melt it, you know, a lot of ice up in the North Pole. But over time, they know they can get a lot of water. And yes, then they can get oxygen. They can get hydrogen for fuel, not only for fuel for rockets, but, you know, to run equipment on Mars. You'll be able to have fuel cells, if you want to develop fuel cells for power. You'll also be able to take that water, put it into a greenhouse, and you're going to have to pressurize the greenhouse. Once you do that, you'll be able to grow food on the soil. They know the soil that they use there will grow stuff. You're still only going to have vegetables. You're going to be a vegetarian. So, I don't know what you... I guess they'll have to take up protein pills. You know, your body does need protein. I think they're going to have to bring a lot of protein pills with them, Dick. But now Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter is getting old. We also have Mars Global Surveyor. That thing has quit working. We have Odyssey. Odyssey's been going around since 01. That's still functioning, still working as a repeater. But there's plans on the table now at NASA to eventually replace these satellites. There's no name, there's no funding, but they're talking about it now, where probably in 2020 or as late as 2022, they're definitely going to need some kind of replacements. These satellites aren't going to last forever. Back to you, Dick.
How about fish tanks and cows and spacesuits?
In the case of Biosphere 2, I think they had billy goats. They did have fish in the pond. They had a number of animals, and I believe they were getting protein by that means. Isn't that true, Paul Grant?
Yes. They had chickens and eggs, and everything that you possibly have on Earth. They had a savanna. Desert like area, and they had an ocean. Each section of the biosphere contained different things, you know, but they had their own forest. So that's what they tried to do. They tried to duplicate everything. It pretty much worked. I mean, toward the end, they did have to let some oxygen in to make up for the oxygen, like you said in the beginning, with them being soaked up by the concrete. You know, as time goes on, they figure these things out, and they will compensate for it in future experiments, but that experiment eventually quit. By the way, this is all took place in Arizona, and place went defunct. I mean, broke. And in fact, they were thinking about leveling it, putting up a mall. The State University of Arizona stepped in, and now they run the whole thing. Back to you, Dick.
I think University of Arizona has purchased it and is now running a number of experiments with their students. So it's a valuable structure. A number of good science fiction stories lead you to believe that you have this self-sustaining biosphere on a spaceship, and the spaceship is on a very long journey that might last for years, that you're going to be growing your own food on the way. And by some means, you're going to, maybe with light-emitting diodes, you're going to create artificial sunlight. The power to run those is going to come from a nuclear source. And you'd like to believe that you can grow enough food and survive and create enough living animals that you've now got a complete diet for your astronauts for years on end. In the case of Biosphere 2, 3.14 acres, probably 3.14, I think that's why they chose it. 3.14 acres, I guess they had calculated, would allow 8 people to survive. 4 guys, 4 women. 4 women, 4 guys. And except for the fact that the oxygen got mysteriously sucked up by the concrete, I think they came close. And maybe the right answer is not 8 people, but 5 or 6 people per 3.14 acres. Well, 3.14 acres is a lot of area. If you're trying to supply that on a spaceship, and that Biosphere 2, let me drop it, has a mass of a zillion tons. And for every pound you put into orbit or try to put into space, you use a hell of a lot of rocket fuel. So to recreate that in space and to make it a viable, self-sustaining system of recycling every molecule, I mean, on a very long mission, what you're really trying to do is to take every single molecule of air, fluid, and solids that comes out of a human being 24/7, capture every one of those molecules, because you've only got a finite number of them on that spaceship, and recycle them, turn them back into air, food, and water that's all potable. The machinery to do that right now is a very serious challenge. But I'm going to jump subjects for a second now. How many transmitters are there in the world? Let me drop. I mean, I could start counting the transmitters that are on the Empire State Building, that are in all the broadcast centers for AM and FM, all the radar sites and so on. How many transmitters are there? There's really an infinite number of transmitters. The WMAP, I can't even think of the names of these spacecraft now that have recently measured all the background radiation, the cosmic background radiation.
Planck is another one.
Planck, Herschel is the latest, Planck is the one before it, WMAP is before that, and COBE, Cosmic Background Explorer, COBE is the one before that.
So it's primarily infrared.
Still, what they were doing, though, is they were measuring what we call background radiation. And so what I'm getting at is what's really going on here with the Mars orbiter that measured that water that was flowing on Mars. And we now say with fairly high probability, you know how much oxygen, how much hydrogen, and how much salt is in that. And how do you know that? Because it was transmitting that information to you. Everything transmits. Everything that's above absolute zero is a transmitter. My body transmitted 2287.5 megahertz radio signal, a random noise radio signal, that almost pegged the needle on a very sensitive radiometer that was connected to the feed horn on that 12-foot dish that I was tuning up, that I was going to go listen to the Apollo 15 astronauts. And I'm standing on a wooden chair with my hands on the feed horn. I'm trying to change the polarization and the position of the feed horn. The radiometer connected to that feed horn was running, and somebody noticed that while I'm standing there, the needle got pegged. We soon realized that the hot 2.3 gigahertz signal coming coming off my body is what that very sensitive system was using, was measuring. So everything emits a signal. The sun shining on those molecules of brackish water flowing on Mars gives you an input signal. You know what the solar spectrum looks like. Let me drop it. You aim a high-gain telescope that has the right kind of equipment behind it at that water that's running down that hill, and you look at the spectrum that gets reflected. And if you have the right kind of spectral analysis, you look at the individual lines of resonance of hydrogen, oxygen, water, and so on, and salt, and if you recognize that signature, you can say, yes, I know what that material is. Everything above absolute zero is a transmitter. It's a transmitter of black body radiation. You could ask the question backwards. Tell me what doesn't radiate. If you have a sensitive enough receiver, what in this universe is not radiating? You probably are not going to be able to answer that question. Let me drop.
How about a black hole, Dick?
You read any of the articles by Stephen Hawking about black hole radiation. Those black holes are radiating like crazy, if you know how to look for it. A lot of the energy that goes into the black hole, not all of it is being emitted out because of the, what you call the surface, in other words, the event horizon, is the speed of light is higher than the escape velocity, so an awful lot of the stuff inside is not talking to you directly, but there's a lot of stuff on the surface that's talking to you. We're measuring the black holes that are in the center of every single galaxy, is the conclusion we're coming to, by the radiation that's occurring at the surface of those black holes. So everything above absolute zero is a transmitter, and every one of those transmitters has a very specific signature of individual spectral lines, individual frequencies of individual amplitudes. Every object that's above absolute zero, if you've got the right test equipment, the right kind of a receiver, the right kind of a radiometer, radio telescope, call it what you like, you look at all the possible frequencies, the information is there. Everything is a transmitter if you've got sensitive enough equipment. The amateur radio operators, let me drop.
I have a comment.
Okay, I'll get you in a minute, Wes. We pride ourselves in being able to build or buy efficient transmitters, set up efficient transmission lines, connected to efficient high-performance antennas with high gain. We amateurs pride ourselves in doing that. And now we make very specific transmissions on very specific frequencies, usually on ham bands, and we talk to each other with that. And so these are very specific high-power transmitters. High power is sometimes a QRP transmitter of a couple of milliwatts or a couple of watts. And I will admit that all of the things that are above absolute zero in temperature that are transmitting right now, the actual signal strength they're transmitting, I will admit it's extremely weak. That doesn't stop it from transmitting. That doesn't stop it from you receiving it. As long as you've got the right equipment with enough sensitivity and the right kind of spectral analysis, everything is a transmitter. You can't stop it. So of all the things that I've challenged you guys to give me something and this is an example of something that does not transmit, and falls for the black hole doesn't. I will admit that the percentage of radiation out of the black hole compared to its mass, I will admit that that's an extremely low ratio. Let me drop. But it's transmitting like crazy. Everything transmits. It's just a matter of designing, you as an engineer, design the right receiver. There's a hell of a lot of signals coming out of absolutely everything, sitting there waiting for you to pick them up and analyze them if you want to know what in the world it is that you're looking at. N2XJN, K2RIW, go ahead, Wes.
While you were talking, sitting over to a point where much different view at travel to Mars by a human being. Actually, it doesn't cause a pen. First, I would like to point at National Geographic. Mark Kaufman published April 23, 2014. the astronauts to Mars could be done a small fraction of the cost of developing flying F-35 fighter jet. According to the rough estimate put forward by panel NASA, industry and academic experts, there was one trillion figure that was on the table, and we were to destroy 1 trillion just to get to Mars would be much better. Interesting fact is that some is getting the credit.
Yeah, Wes, fine.
Interesting fact is that when Putin tried to bomb Ukraine, he didn't spend at the beginning one single penny. What he was doing is utilization. For dozens of years, there was stuff that was accumulated and all was needed just to use. But after 1 year, the reserves were actually finished. And now, instead of Ukraine, is switching to Syria. Because this part of weaponry wasn't used. And expecting a year from now, he's going to be in a shortage with it. So in other words, the wealth of the devices that John is buying, I'm buying, for pennies, is because there's so much of accumulation. Now, instead of just redirecting funds for killing each other, if that redirection of funds would be made towards space travel, there is a rough estimate that if all money in the world would be redirected to space travel, would be able to send one spacecraft per day. So, in other words, what I'm trying to point here is when a big country or a big set of countries like United Europe is redirecting the money to different tasks, playgrounds, parks, whatever, animal control, animal savings, whatever. That money are in within a chain of the closed structure. They never leave the structure. There is no losses, no net losses. It's just moving the funds for the human to do the job. But the funds comes in forms of the money, and again is the same. But I'm trying to say that I actually agree the statement of Mark Kaufman from National Geographic and plenty of others. It doesn't cost us a penny. It's an illusion, John, Dick, and so is here.
Yeah, if we could stop all wars and stop spending money on building that kind of material. And there's even some benefit there. Even when you're building war material, there is a fallout. I don't think the fallout is anywhere near as high as it is with NASA. If we could stop all wars and put all of the money and bloodshed that we put into that into better gold, of course there'd be a huge benefit. But boy, to do that is not easy. I'm probably quite naive, but all of our involvement in the Middle East, I don't think we've gotten our money's worth. We got involved in the first place because of the first Gulf War, because of Saddam Hussein taking over Kuwait, and it looked like he was going to take over Saudi Arabia. He was going to take over those oil fields. And if we didn't act real fast, and we lost that flow of oil, our vehicles wouldn't move, wouldn't be able to run our war machine. We'd lose the ability to then recapture, if you know what I mean. I don't know where you were in roughly 1973, I think it was, during the so-called gas embargo, I think it was called an oil embargo, where we were all sitting on very long lines on odd and even days just to put fuel in our automobiles, and that's because of a couple of percent of decrease in the oil flow that the United States imports. Let me drop. Our need for energy is so great, and right now one of the greatest sources of energy the United States uses, and there's well as many other countries, is oil. And if that oil doesn't continuously flow, we don't manufacture, we don't heat our homes, we don't move our automobiles, we don't move our trucks, we don't do anything. We have the resources to be energy independent. But for the time being, we need that oil flow, and I think that's our reason for being in the Mideast.
Well,
if we didn't need that oil flow, we could have sit back, and watch the individual countries in the Mideast fight each other, as they've been doing for thousands of years, and we wouldn't have had to gotten involved. Because until we got involved and all of a sudden they started getting angry at us, they weren't considering us a target. So we didn't have to get involved in that war for our protection. We didn't need that protection if we didn't need that oil. And the sooner we become energy independent, and the more we are less dependent on foreign oil, the less we get involved in wars where we're probably going to make very little benefit. It turns out that in the latest issue of 60 Minutes, let me drop the questions that President Obama was being asked were along the lines of, hey, you're too chicken to get in there and get involved with Syria and straighten out their situation. But he's basically saying, no matter what in the world we do, it is so complicated for us to make a significant improvement in all the huge number of refugees, of people vacating that civil war in Syria, and you've got millions of people going to other countries. And do we think we can walk in there with troops on the ground or planes in the air and any other technique and suddenly make that all turn good? There is no silver bullet. There is no glamour fix there. And for us to get involved at all, you can accuse Obama of being inactive because we're not involved per se. But even if we were involved and we started sending our money and our bloodshed, would we really correct it? I'm kind of doubtful. It's a very complicated situation that's been going on for a large number of years. And we'd like to believe that we can walk in there and say, hey, there's this great benefit of being a democratic country, and why don't you join our bandwagon and become democratic? You can say those words. I don't think they're going to hear it. Anybody have comments on this? Give me your call letters. K2RIW.
Yeah, I'm to exchange.
Okay, Wes was one comment. Was there another person?
BGB.
Okay, Wes and John in that order. Yes, I'm naive, but I don't think we should get involved in Syria. There's no simple solution. Over to you, Wes, K2RIW.
Yeah, I would like you guys to think white. You got to see a certain mechanism here, especially when it's to Iraq, and the oil wasn't cheaper, although Iraq had plenty of oil. And then we had a Katrina, and because of Katrina, there was a shortage, and the price goes up. And then it goes up, and it goes up, and it goes up, and it goes close to $5, whatever. All of a sudden, and we were told, at first we were told about weapons of mass destruction that didn't exist, that's why we went to war, and then we were told that the cost of digging for oil is so great that we don't understand it. And we were sort of pushed to understand. Let me jump. So then, drops rapidly because of the Russian invasion, whatever the reason, it drops. And then one could question how much it is possible that the oil dropped that much if oil digging cost that much money. Why do we have so much of oil? Or you say, well, it's too much of oil, that's why it becomes cheaper. No, the cost of digging is the same. We are having a closed loop. It's a closed system. This closed system has nothing to do with reality. That reality is created for us by the guys who rule the world. In other words, what I'm trying to say is the devil of the United States exists, but on the other hand, doesn't exist. They can go around if you want to. And they have the tools to do it. Again, with oil and with everything else.
my understanding is
the powers of the world don't want independence. They want to have something that they have to fight with. Finishing Russia economically would be very bad, because now America cannot spend money for Hungary, because there is nobody to fight. Thank you, Garcia.
Thank you for your comment. John, you want to make a comment. Go ahead.
DC2WGB. Yeah, Dick, I agree with you. It's very complicated. And don't forget, when that 72 oil crunch came, the oil embargo, we had the oil cartels taking advantage of that. They were sending ships around longer ways, delaying imports and all that. That is complicated. And the $19 trillion is a legitimate number. It is a debt, and we owe it. You know, we're working out. But now, to get back to Syria, with all these people, hundreds of thousands leaving the countries, that was not taking place when we were there, and we kept a cap on it. When we left, and we thought we had trained soldiers who just dropped all their weapons and left them to ISIS and all those other terrorists, or whatever you want to call them, that was a mistake, and that's what caused a lot of this migration of the citizens of those countries. We didn't act properly there. It's really, just like you said, it is a mess. And I agree, there's no magic bullet, and there's no magic way to do it. Thousands of years they've been fighting. They probably will be fighting for quite a few hundred more. But, you know, in their country, I don't care what they do. It's only when they step across the border and threaten us, that's when it's time to take them on. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
I'm a little shy on history here, John. You made it sound like we, the United States, walked out of Syria. What was our involvement in Syria? How many Americans, so to speak, do we have there? Roughly what year? What were they doing there? And we walked out and left a vacuum and created this problem? I don't think it's quite that simple. I don't remember great involvement of the United States in Syria, but I'm pretty shy on history, I guess. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
Well, the problem with the Middle East was exacerbated when Britain wanted to keep the Suez, and we did not step up and defend them and help them. We let them get crushed and kicked out. That's what really started the demise, and then the nationalization of the oil fields and all of that stuff. Okay. The problem was we were in Iraq. We were in Iran, and we were keeping the lid on the garbage can. The fact that we left, now nobody is afraid because they know we don't do anything and we back down on our promises to support them. We're withdrawing troops too early. That exit plan just didn't work, and that's what caused most of this trouble that we're experiencing right now. Yeah, we weren't in Syria, but, you know, the Syrians and the Egyptians were having problems, and but we had a control over that. It's a shame that we have to have an army there and have all our men dying, but that was helping. As soon as we backed off and we let them take over, they went right back to the fishbowl. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
And you said we had control over that. I'm not convinced of that one, John. We wanted to convince ourselves we had some control. I kind of doubt it. And that as terrible as Saddam Hussein was, he was creating a certain amount of stability in that country. And yeah, he's a bad guy and we eliminated him, and we think that was a benefit. We created some destabilization. Don't think we have the ability or the resources to stabilize any one of those Mideast countries without spending tremendous amounts of billions of dollars and gallons of American blood. I just don't think we can do that. And our population will not support that any longer. They think it's another Vietnam War, if you know what I mean. I mean, the majority of our population in each one of those key periods of time said, please recall our troops. Get them out of there. We've already lost thousands of American lives, many billions of American dollars, and we didn't get very much benefit out of it. We didn't get our money's worth. And we think we're going to convert them into a democratic society, and they're going to suddenly jump into our way of thinking. I doubt it. A hell of a lot of history would have to be changed, historic attitudes, and education. And these words roll off the tongue real easily to make it really happen. Wow. I'm going to give you a very tough question, John. If your name was President of the United States right now, and you'd like to straighten out Syria, you'd like to straighten out Afghanistan, you'd like to straighten out Iraq and Iran, and if I asked you, what would you do? I don't think there's any kind of a answer you could give that Congress and the American public would accept. That's a guess on my part.
Repeater, time out.
As I said, to give an answer to that one, which is an impossible question, I don't think there's an answer, but maybe you think there is one, John. KC2WGB, KQIW.
Well, I don't think like a diplomat, but there are a couple of issues. The exacerbation of the situation there happened when we left because ISIS was not in existence at that time. We had Al-Qaeda, but they were under control. Yeah, they were doing things, but not like they're doing now. So, what do we do? To make a deal with a nation that is threatening the death of Israel, death to America, and we send a guy over there to make a deal with them, all he did was surrender. He did not pose anything stiff, didn't keep any rigidity in what we wanted. We got nothing on that deal. And it was all done in secret. Nobody was being told. Even our Congress didn't know what was going on. So when you act like that and they see weakness, they pounce on it, just like any animal does in the real animal world. And all animals show their strength in physical violence. Now, Putin over there and the Russians, let him bomb the rebels who we don't know if they're friends or not. Let him bomb ISIS. Let him bomb everybody over there, and we won't lose any men. Just the problem is, how much more do we let it grow before we have to do something? Maybe we won't have to do anything. Maybe he'll clean house over there. I hope so. It would be nice. And the dictator who's in there now that we don't like, why don't we like him? What is the problem? You know, we're all fed a story. What's the truth? We really don't know. Nobody here knows. But we're finding out things that are just not acceptable to Americans. But I agree with you. I don't think one guy should die over there. Not one of ours. But over there, with them, I don't really care. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
Let me comment on it.
John, it's real easy to say we didn't do it right. Because, yes, it didn't turn out well. I don't think there was any we could have done it right. No matter how many troops we put in, if we had quadrupled the number of troops and we think we're taking control, you think we had the Taliban under control, I doubt it. We had the illusion of some amount of control in a couple of cities for a certain number of weeks or months of time. Do we really have control of that whole situation? Their philosophy of life and our philosophy of life is so darn different. We weren't talking the same language or the same concepts. I don't think we had real control at any time. We had our population compared to their population was too small a ratio. Our ways of thinking are too different. Their ways of accepting us are too different. From their point of view, we are invaders. Even though we did a beautiful job of supporting Saudi Arabia. We thought that Saddam Hussein had taken over the oil fields in Kuwait. We had good reason to believe he was going to continue walking from Kuwait into Saudi Arabia. And so here we are putting a good number of our troops in Saudi Arabia and defending them, so to speak. But still, even to the Saudis, I think an awful lot of the Saudi population considers us the invaders. We made ourselves targets. I don't think there was any glamour fix here. Yes, it's easy to say we didn't do it right. I'm not convinced there was a right. Maybe I'm very naive. Wes, your language is a little bit difficult to understand, and all of a sudden we're getting an awful lot of jamming, so try to make your answers a little bit more concise. Intellectual
repeater, time out.
Intellect JN, KQIW, go ahead, Wes.
Okay. Well, definitely somebody doesn't like the other side. It is Russia and it is Iran. So if Iran was isolated even more, which is not a big deal, and Russia is about to lose the basis because the currency dropped down, a little bit more push, and Russia cannot do nothing. At this point, we have no support of those two countries. And this is real. The problem is that Western world doesn't want to finish Russia. They don't have to fight over there. They don't have to do nothing. The Russian population will revolt, and they will create another capitalistic country. People are proud to blow out right now. This is the situation in Russia. And now we're talking about easing. So finish Russia economically, isolate Iran, and then whatever is there, you don't care. Hungry people have to go where the money is, and they have to sell what they have. And to Asia. John.
No, I'm sorry, I've said my piece, really. Nothing went ahead. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, the way the Gulf War got started was that it is my belief that Saddam Hussein was to some degree licking his wounds after World War II, so to speak. The redistricting, the resetting of property lines, of country barriers after World War II, from his point of view, cut off his access to the sea, cut off those oil fields that are now Kuwaiti that he thought used to be Iraqi, and he thought he's recapturing his land. He thought he was justified in doing that, even though he's doing it by fairly severe techniques. Everybody has got a way of explaining it. And from his point of view, the first Gulf War, he won it from his point of view. We're getting pretty far away from ham radio. And, all kinds of radio transmitters are required to fight a war. And all kinds of satellites and drones and F-35s that we were mentioning earlier, and expensive hardware, and it's expensive in dollars and expensive in American blood. Just like the Vietnam War, we're not getting our money's worth. How are we going to involve in any of these? We can look at it now with 20/20 hindsight and say that had we seen the future, I don't think we would have walked down this particular street, if you know what I mean. John, for a while you were going to, I'm changing the subject, John. For a while you were going to put up a tower. I haven't heard you talking about that tower. As a tower owner, I can tell you it's an awful lot of fun. I'm a little bit disappointed that I think you may have given up that project, John. For the short periods of time where somebody has come onto your property with machinery capable of holding an antenna up high, so that you are already on a beautiful high piece of land there in Staten Island, and with just a little bit more tower, boy, could you be having an awful lot of fun. As you raise your antenna high enough and you start talking greater range on single sideband on 2 meters, 432, 1296, 6 meters, whatever is your favorite band, but as you've got some real range with some altitude, and you start talking to people out of the area and you start picking their brains, as I was doing on 432 for a number of years, I had enough range to talk to 420 people way back in 1973 on 432. And some of them were extremely interesting people in important positions, but you couldn't tell without doing some research, because typical of ham radio operators, they're very humble people, if you know what I mean. They don't tend to brag about the great positions they hold in their work, in their military involvement or whatever. So I'm a little bit disappointed that I think you've almost given up the tower project, John. KC2WGB, K2RW in the TechNet.
WGB. Well, I haven't given up. I've already completed the design. It'll be manufactured on site. I'm going to buy a tower, and I have two types, a very simple one and then one that's a little more complicated. I had a contractor here and got some prices, and it's not going to be expensive. It's just I haven't pulled the trigger yet. I want to do it. You know, about considering, look at my age, how much use will I get out of it, but I'll probably do it, but I was going to try to have it in this spring that just passed, but I didn't make that, so possibly early spring, I'll probably be trying again.
When it comes to commercially made tower, Rhone 25, Rhone 45, Rhone 55, and there's some other brands of crank-up, but I like not crank-up. The design of those towers have been around for so many decades. They've got such an extremely good track record. And they're not that expensive. By your and my economic standards, radio tower is quite cheap. You install it, it's good for 25 years, so to speak. And if you're willing to accept a little bit of rust, it'll last for 40 years. One of my towers, let me think now, I think I used it for 45 years altogether. You know, in an industrial environment, the galvanizing is only rated for 25 years. So, a commercial tower, whether it be crank-up, self-standing, and so on, tilt-over, is so well established that for you to manufacture tower on site, don't recommend that, John. Yeah, with a real good mechanical engineer, you can do that. But to turn your back on that history and track record of the commercially available towers that are not that expensive, I would be trying to change your mind on that a little bit, John. And you're worried about how long you and I are going to live. The amount of fun you get out of it, even if it only lasts for 3 years, is more than worth it, in my opinion. Because with that fortune you and I have, having some fun with him, with that fortune you and I have, are we just going to leave it to our offspring? KC2WGB, K2RIW, and the TechNet?
Well, I'm so impoverished now, I'm actually eating lint off the carpet. No, I have a nice, simple structure that is similar to a flagpole, out of a wide flange, 16-inch, 5/8 beam. So that will go up in one piece. It will be similar to a flagpole with the two stanchions, and it will be something that can be lowered very easily. And on the top of that, I could put a 3-inch pipe. So if I go up 40 feet, I could put a 15-foot 3-inch pipe on top of that and put all of my antennas up there and have it lower up and down in the driveway with no problem. And I can get a used wide flange for almost nothing. So that's a very cheap tower. The materials would probably cost me maybe $400.
You're talking roughly how many feet of altitude, John?
We'll figure approximately 40 feet further, or for the wide flange, maybe 35, and another 15, 20 feet of pipe. There you go, about 50 feet, 55.
I will admit that commercial tower, crank up, tilt over, or self-standing for that altitude, commercially made, is going to be twice that number of dollars. I'll admit that. But it's a modular structure that even if you don't want to climb, when you hire a rigger, can easily climb it. You have the ability to easily strap things along the sides at various altitudes. It's got a built-in step ladder, if you know what I mean. A flagpole, I'll admit it looks good, and it's low in cross-sectional area. But to have to bring it all the way down to make minor changes is a little more elaborate than you would think. A structure that has a built-in staircase, self-standing, crank-up, and tilt-over, all have that. The built-in hidden advantage there, John, that your rigger will thank you for it, and you don't have to bring the whole thing all the way down just because you want to tighten a bolt or add one more antenna. Just by walking up the step ladder and strapping it and tightening U-bolts wherever you want. Give that some thought, John. There's a lot to be said with the conventional way of using tower material that's available to you. It's not that expensive. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
Well, it takes up a big footprint, much bigger than the system that I have. I do have the tower design, too, but I like the girder because up and down, and I can also, it's so big, I could weld a ladder onto it, or just some rods across the flanges, and that would be the ladder to go up and down. That would be no problem at all, and it's not adding any my purpose. The SEALs may not want to try to do that. And I've worked with SEALs so much that there's no problem.
Is that like an I-beam, John? WS to I?
Yes, you could call it an I-beam. It's actually a wide flange.
I think they call that an H-beam. I will admit that the commercial towers that I'm talking about do have more visibility, more cross-section. And when they're brand new and they're shiny, yeah, they show up pretty loud to the neighbors. However, depending on whether you've got oak trees or maple trees or whatever, you choose the right kind of brown paint. There are all kinds of brown paint made for towers that are not very expensive, made by Pittsburgh, by the way. And you paint the tower with brown paint. Its visibility becomes not much different than the trunk of a tree. So you can take the visibility away. But to have the built-in ladder and modularization, the commercial tower comes in 10-foot sections. So if you decide later on to raise or lower the total structure altitude by another 10 feet by adding or subtracting a section, it's easy. So the modularity and the track record and the history is what I'm voting on this one, John, and give it some extra thought. You found a way to make it less visible and less costly. Let me drop. But you're going to be losing modularity and easy accessibility. The fact that you can tilt it over. On paper, it sounds good. You talk to people who really have a significant number of antennas on a tower, and they want to be able to tilt it over. Not quite as easy as you think. Doesn't work out quite as smoothly as you'd like. As you can tell, I've been using the kind of towers I'm talking about since 1967. The first 4 years I lived on a piece of rental property, I had 80 feet of tower on that property. With the landlord's permission, that took some doing. Over to you, John, K2RIW. I guess we're getting a little shy on time.
Yeah, only got a couple of minutes left. You know, the tower, if I was going that high, I would definitely take a wrong or something like that, because I wouldn't want to try to put something together. That'd be very inconvenient to work with, difficult to move. But don't forget, at 40 to 50 feet, I have bucket trucks and boom trucks available to me. So even now, when I have to work on an antenna, I could lower the pipes, but I don't. I usually get the bucket truck over here, run up and do any adjustments I have to do. So that works for me. But let me thank everyone for joining us on the net. And if everything goes well, we're going to return next week and answer all of these problems. Back to you, Dick, KC2 WGB.
You believe that, we'll tell you another one. And by the way, 40, 50, 60 feet of self-standing tower with no guy wires. Nowadays, that's easy, John. Okay, give it some thought. Bye-bye, you all, and see you next week. K2RIW clear. And Paul, you got any final comments? WS2N? And would you even go into biosphere, Paul? WS2N? K2RIW?
No, that's, you're not even going anywhere. Just staying in Arizona. No, I wouldn't. I'm more fascinated with this I-beam, or what you call an H-beam. I always call them I-beam. You should look at them from the side. They kind of look like an I. But yeah, if you turn it the other way, it looks like an H. But I'm more fascinated on how he's going to mount it to the concrete. I'll have to wait until time goes on. We run out, unfortunately. The net is coming to a close. Space report number 170 is over. John, over to you. This is WS2N.
Well, Paul, enjoy the weekend. You also, Dick, was already on the net. Have fun. And, yeah, no big thing. But, and steel is cheap, and it's readily available, almost free. And you don't have to paint it. The rust looks good.
Yeah, I paint my towers brown these days so that it looks like rust, but it doesn't rust. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder. If you can make your tower look the same color as the oak trees on your property, I think you've achieved a certain amount of success. But that's an opinion. Bye-bye, you all.
DD2,
the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system. Node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system. Node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
Good morning. The time is 1:37 a.m. Set tonight at 8:30 WQVL repeater system.
That's fine.
my routine. Officially, unless I make personal appointments, I don't have to be there until 8:30. But I just get up, get dressed, get out, and I have breakfast when I get to work.
We used to do that on a regular basis. We were very fortunate. It was a relatively decent diner, practically right across the street from the building I worked in. And, you know, like three or four of us would go over there around 9 o'clock or 9:30 for breakfast. And that would be the beginning of our day, but we had to be there at 7 o'clock.
Well, if I didn't have a crazy schedule, I could take the train. That would afford me to relax a little bit instead of driving. I've considered doing that on Fridays because I've got a normal commute. Go in at this time and come back. I leave Manhattan every other Friday around 5:30. That's deadly on the roads.
Hope you're back on lunch for that trip. Because I know coming home on Friday in the evening rush hour, you take the rest of your adult life. My wife goes in twice a week on the LIRR. She gets it out of Hicksville and just jumps on the train and relaxes and gets off at Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn.
Well, there is one thing that can be said for doing that, that you're not frustrated on the road all by yourself. That's one of the advantages of having the radio in the car. Advantage, you get packed in like a sardine if you get a seat. And railroad is not the most reliable railroad there is.